And my thing is that everything we need, we already have.
Yeah.
And that's also in that wrapped up is the internal confidence to be able to put your hand up to say, I don't know what I'm doing. Hmm. So everything we need, we already have. And when you feel that, it changes everything again, because that allows a confidence to say, I've got a whole heap of great stuff. I could probably use some more. How do I get that? And who do I reach out to? And where do I put my hand up? And that is about just being confidently yourself. So everything we need, we have, is something I really, I'm going with that at the moment.
This is the Inner the Buzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 104 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses committed to innovation, to service and to modern marketing become even more innovative. In today's interview, I was privileged indeed to speak with Jill Hicks, one of the most inspiring, thought-provoking, powerful and life-affirming speakers that I've heard. Now, inspiring is a word that's often overused, and perhaps I'm guilty of doing that too. But in Jill's case, I think you're going to agree it's totally appropriate. Jill is a survivor of the London terrorist bombings of July the 7th, 2005. She nearly died as a result of her injuries, ended up in hospital for months, and suffered the loss of both legs. Her remarkable courage and determination to truly triumph over tragedy is nothing but inspirational. Now, Jill wrote the book One Unknown, which is a moving account of the tragedy of that bombing and of her survival and her inspirational journey to a new life. Now, I strongly recommend or strongly encourage everyone to read that book. Jill now speaks publicly. She operates an international not-for-profit called MAD for Peace, M-A-D for Peace, which stands for Making a Difference. She's a very sought-after speaker, as I said, and an advocate for peace and understanding in the world. Now, without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from the inspirational Jill Hicks. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to have today as my guest on the InnovaBuzz podcast from Adelaide in South Australia, Jill Hicks. Now, Jill is one of the most inspiring, I'm getting my notes wrong here, she's one of the most inspiring, thought-provoking, powerful and life-affirming speakers in Australia today, and I'll let her tell a little bit of her story, because if you don't know Jill's story, it's quite, I don't know what the right word is, but it's pretty full-on, and it's, her attitude and what she does today is nothing to describe it but inspiring. So, Jill, welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast. It's such a privilege to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Jürgen. Lovely to be here.
So, yeah, so Jill was publishing director of the architecture, design and contemporary culture magazine Blueprint. She was director of a multidisciplinary design and publishing group, and she was head of curation at the UK's Design Council back in 2005, when all things changed for her in a breath, I think you call it. So tell us what happened, basically, for those people that don't know your story.
Well, I was, just a commuter, as I would be every day in London. And on July the 7th, 2005, it was the only day that I was running late for work. So I was regularly someone who would be in my office by approximately 7:30 most mornings. And this was one day that I was running late, and of course not a day to be running late, because I boarded exactly the same train carriage at the same time as a suicide bomber. who turned out to be one of four suicide bombers with a planned attack on London transport networks that morning. So the bomb went off at 8:50 a.m., so 10 to 9. And unbeknown to me, of course, and to everybody in the carriage that we were in, this 19-year-old young man had a bomb in his backpack. He was standing one person away from me in the carriage, and he detonated his device, killing and maiming many, killing 26 around me and maiming several in my immediate surrounds. And life changed forever from that moment, Jürgen. I actually think of exactly that time as a very strong demarcation mark of the end of life as I knew it, and absolutely fortunately and wonderfully for me, the beginning of another life, but a very different life than I could ever have anticipated.
And for those people listening in, I strongly encourage you to read Jill's book called One Unknown, and you'll tell us about how that title came about in a moment, I'm sure. It's a very moving account of the tragedy of that bombing and of Jill's survival and her inspirational journey to this new life that she talks about. So now you're operating an international not-for-profit, which is called MAD for Peace, M-A-D, Make a Difference, and you're a very sought-after public speaker. Now, I want to give a shout-out to Fiona Kerr, who introduced us and suggested we interview Jill on the podcast. So thanks, Fiona, and big shout-out to you as well.
She's another amazing fellow South Australian. Actually, yeah. I'm very fortunate to not only know but do lots of work with Fiona. So, yes, amazing.
So I wondered a lot about where to take this interview today and you know, what to take out of this, because your story is very inspirational, but how to tie that in with business. And I thought of metaphors and looking at exploring the mindset that allowed you to have the incredible strength to survive that experience, not only to survive that experience, but to turn it into what you describe as your new life. And I think it's a life of purpose and selflessness and a commitment to, you know, a particular cause. So yeah, tell us a little bit about some of that.
I think the biggest thing for me that yeah, I've had a lot of time to ponder all of this and try to unravel it and try to understand myself. Yeah, what is it? What is it that's enabled me to firstly, to not harbour a hatred or a bitterness, but to understand that if I channel the anger that's there, that I can use that anger as such a great motivator to really make some positive difference with the life that I've been given back. I think also for the sense of business, again, for me, it's even adapting to incredible change. Now, I've said that I'm absolutely very fortunate to have survived the bomb blast. However, my body was incredibly maimed, and I now live my life with the very permanent injuries of being a double amputee. So I've lost both legs, and you know that's an ever-changing feast in itself. So even being I'd rather not use the word disabled as such, but being a person that's life is then compromised in every single way and challenged, it's continuous in how I'm having to learn to adapt and adjust to change. Because change didn't only happen for me at 10 to 9 on the 7th of July 2005. Change is happening then every single day after that event. So that in itself has been a really interesting skill to develop, to first acknowledge that, oh, okay, change actually should be something that we don't look at with surprise, but we should look at as it's a given that change is happening all the time around us. Hopefully it's so small in its increments that we that it goes barely unnoticed, but sometimes it's seismic. Yeah. And for me, it's how do we really, I think, acknowledge that we have these inherent, fantastic abilities to be able to not only face change, but to adapt and to adjust and to be quite nimble with it all. And all of that has come back around to me understanding that actually the only thing that I have absolute power over is my ability to choose how I'm going to react and respond. So I can't affect, I can't stop change, I can't do anything about it. Once I let that go, I then realized the power I do have is I've got the power of choice. Hmm. And no one can take that from me. I get to choose how I react and how I respond. And for me, that's also then coming back around to saying, how wonderful, Jill, how wonderful that you even have a life. So the association of pain, of discomfort, of challenge, I've then bracketed into being one of the positive markers to say, I'm here, and I get to feel stuff. And how brilliant is that? And I get to choose how I react and how I respond to every single challenge. And with that type of attitude, which I guess evolved quite naturally. So it's only been, you know, the last few years that I've been able to recognize and call it something. That's enabled me, I think, to have quite a good, I would say, healthy mindset in how I evolve my own life and how I steer the direction of my life, and indeed how I've gone on to face some really difficult work challenges as well as physical challenges, and to be absolutely adamant that my whole driving belief is that, how do I honour the life I've been given back? And for me, that's absolutely about what is the footprint I leave now? What is the legacy I leave now? And how do I, Jill Hicks, make a difference?
Hmm. Yeah, that's quite good. And the, you know, having your own choices and the ability to react and respond to any situation, I think that was one of the really powerful messages I took out of the book and some of the presentations that I saw you give, and I've written that down and thought that in itself is a very powerful metaphor for life. And I was in a group that I mentor on Facebook this morning, and a young person there was going off a treatise, so to speak, a little bit at a situation that was really just a trivial little thing. And I thought, this is a little change, and it doesn't really mean what it probably doesn't mean what you think it means, and you're just not reacting right. You're causing yourself more grief by reacting the way you do. So I think that is a very powerful message, and particularly, you know, if you can choose a reaction that you have chosen and a response that you have chosen in a really extreme situation that not many people would be faced with, then, that's a lesson for everybody, I think.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, Jürgen, for me is not so much mental health, but it's also been exploring mind health and looking at our thoughts and how do we become the great gatekeepers of our thoughts, because that they can very, very quickly take us down a path of destructive, almost sabotaging-like action. And so for me, it's being very, very vigilant around mind health and making sure that I'm always there, present with my thoughts. And the moment negative thoughts start to form, I'm aware of it and I say, come on, we need to stop that and turn this around and look at how do we make choices that are best for me and best for my body and best for the outcome and best for the for honouring this short breath of time that we're here for. You know, that's the other thing that's been, I think, monumental for me of acknowledging again just how short a time we get to be here and how important it is to let things go and really focus on what matters.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it's scary in a way, isn't it, the time that we're here. I'm not sure this might have been before your time, but I was watching something on the news yesterday. It's the 50th anniversary tomorrow of the disappearance of the Beaumont children in Adelaide, which was a huge case at the time, and you know, it's a big crime and it's a cold case. It still isn't solved 50 years later. So that's why it was on the news. And I thought, oh gosh, 50 years, because I sort of, you know, that obviously made big news headlines at the time. And I was a teenager, so I'm giving away my age here. I was a teenager at the time and I thought, you know, that had an impact on me. I thought how terrible and all the usual thoughts, I guess. And so now it's 50 years later. So, yeah, time goes by in a flash.
A blink, yeah. Mm.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your work then at Mad for Peace and, you know, how that came about and also what each of us as individuals and also as, you know, for people that are listening here, most of whom are business owners, what businesses can do to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. There's two parts to Mad for Peace. So again, I've been sort of taking some time out to explore the barriers to even the word peace, and so then I've started to think about, okay, I'm going to develop a sideline to Mad for Peace, which is called Mad Minds, and how we can get some great thinkers to really contribute to finding, I guess, alternatives to destructive ideologies. So the whole premise of my work is around countering violent extremism. And if you like, that's the long version of what the term, perhaps more familiar, is how do we stop terrorism, basically. And very acutely to me, it's, you know, you can't bomb and kill an idea, because an idea is what lives in people's minds. It's what's easily spread. It's what ignites particularly young minds. And so I then started to look at where are the alternative ideas? How are we luring people away from a very destructive pathway into something perhaps where they can be constructive? And where is that? Where are we doing that? And there was no evidence that I could find. So I thought that's perhaps my area that I could start to really work in, and that is creating alternative ways, alternative ideas, or, if you like, plant the seed of doubt into those who are already starting to be swayed by this ideology. And that then sort of, I guess, really played with my background within design. So I thought, this is fantastic. I'm now starting to be able to knit together my life number one and life number two. So what I loved in even thinking about speaking with you today was how difficult it is to ever communicate to anyone of exactly what it is I do. So essentially, what is the elevator pitch? And I thought, oh, crumbs, where do I start? Because normally I lose people at the word peace, you know. So for me then, I thought, well, I think if I had to make it really short and succinct, it would be that I creatively counter violent extremism by offering alternatives or alternative ideas and pathways to something that's very destructive. And So that's in a nutshell what I do, extrapolating that out. It's looking at a whole range of things of using my body to speak where there's perhaps language barriers. So I've challenged myself to do abseiling or do wonderfully choreographed pieces, just short films, showing my body without legs, putting legs on, walking off screen, all these sorts of things to show that there is the senselessness, if you like, what's happened to me and how do we make sense of that? Right down to I do one-to-one talks with people who are of a persuasion of a very destructive way of thinking. So there's several strands to the work. I team up with people throughout the world who are exactly of this grain of thought, if you like, that prevention is one of the best ways we can find to stop these very, you know, horrific attacks from happening. And so I work with people in Syria, in Pakistan, in the United States, right across the board. And I think we're cutting ground. You know, for me, it's what's difficult from I guess if you put it in terms of a business perspective, is when people say, what's your measure for success? And gosh, you know, I don't have one. But then I started to think, well, perhaps I need one. So my great measure of success is to say that every day there hasn't been a suicide bombing is a great day for us. And wonderfully, these occurrences are still extremely, extremely rare, particularly in Western countries. I can't vouch for the atrocities that are happening in Syria and Pakistan, and indeed in Iraq, but certainly in Western countries, it's still a very, very, very rare thing indeed. And that is something I think that gives us and should give us a great deal of hope.
I think, you know, you touched on something there that I think is really important, that's creating alternatives. And I think it's also around education. I keep seeing horrendous photos of, you know, senseless wars and carpet bombing and whatnot in Syria and Afghanistan and you know, before that in Iraq and so on, and you'd think, you know, the poor people that are stuck there, because, you know, they don't have a choice in the matter, that the, you know, the politicians or the powers that be have decided to go to war with one another, and the few people that are bent on a particular ideology and taking a violent path to enforce that ideology, they're really just a very small minority as well. So you kind of feel, well, how can you break that cycle of violence? Because the next person that comes in and says, like in your situation, you know, that says, well, I'm going to take revenge on somebody for what happened to me, you know, how do you break that cycle?
Yeah, and for me, it's absolutely by the example of very clearly and very, very loudly, I said almost from the day one, of this ends with me. And how powerful that could be if that was how everyone felt that suffered a horrific violation of this ends with me. And how do we break that cycle? How do we then say, okay, this ends with me, but I'm going to now look at a positive response. And that's, to me, the embodiment of everything I do, of it's ended with me, but I haven't gone back to my old life. I've then decided, but I will respond, and I'll respond in a way that is positive and that looks at understanding, firstly, why this happened, and then to say, well, then how can I contribute to the demise of this very horrific, destructive way of thinking and ideology?
And I think, you know, what you've said on the homepage of your website is something that I think it's kind of encapsulates this, and it, because it comes down to every individual behaving in a way towards their fellow human being that actually sets the pattern or sets the behavioural standard for that, doesn't it? And what you've said there is someone somewhere is feeling the effects of something you've said or done, and that's a great responsibility.
And for me, that I came up with that quote because I felt that it really explained the entirety of my whole experience, both the bomber's action to then the actions of every single person who dedicated themselves to saving my life. And so someone somewhere is feeling the effects of something you've said or done. I'm living proof of exactly that quote.
Yeah, I really like that because, and we talked about Fiona earlier. I mean, I think she subscribes to this philosophy too, but we're all connected to each other somewhere, somehow. Yeah. And if you take the, the quantum physics kind of approach that, and this is getting really deep and maybe very scientific and metaphysical too, but what we do, what one of us does impacts everybody else. We don't know how, and we don't necessarily know why, but it's certainly encapsulated by that quote you said there. And to think think a little bit about when you do something, is that going to really serve the world well as yourself?
Absolutely. And I think that the thing that's been really interesting for me, particularly teaming up with Fiona, is that she offers the science to my experience. So I can talk passionately about someone, a stranger, holding my hand. And I felt life being transformed and transported, if you like, from that stranger's hand into mine. How do I even begin to substantiate what was that? Yeah. And this science is brilliant because Fiona's able to say, this is what happened. And this is what happened to your brain while that was happening. And this is what happened to the impact on your body while that was happening. And that's when this becomes really exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting, isn't it?
It really is, because then it demonstrates that this isn't just the hippie, ideology of let's just hug each other and everything will be fine. It's actually great rigor of science to say, actually, there's something in this and we could all thrive if we understood better the power that we can have, the positive power that we can have for each other.
When I met Fiona, she gave a talk at a business networking event here, and one of the points she made was about eye contact, and we were having a chat afterwards about that, and I was reminded of that when I read your book, because a lot of the people that were involved in your rescue and then in your recuperation, particularly those early on, actually, it was later on when people who were your rescuers but didn't know what had happened to you and then saw reports of you leaving hospital and so on, recognised you by your eyes. That was the connection they had to you. They were looking into your eyes to try to keep you conscious in those moments.
Yeah, incredible. Absolutely. And just to say, because of course it doesn't capture this in the book, that all of those people now are like solid family members in my life. I've wonderfully gone on to have a little girl. She's now just turned 5, and she was christened in Russell Square Fountain, and Russell Square, of course, being the tube station that my life was saved at. And there's a beautiful park there in London with a great public fountain, and so she was christened in this fountain, and they were all there as her god family. So it's just beautiful for everything that means, and particularly for me, it's to say to them how extraordinary their efforts were to not only then save my life, but that my life has gone on to create another life. And you know, wow, that's wow.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's must be hard to know what to give back to those people.
Yeah, just they know. Yeah. Because I think I tracked them all down and
stalked them all.
I just said, look, I'm sorry, but a Jill is for life. She's not 5'7". That's it. You've got me now. And they're just, so it's that they, I mean, my closest friend is the paramedic who was first on scene inside the carriage. Her name's Tracy. And we've actually, you know, here we are 12 years on, 13 years, in fact, this year with July. And, you know, it's hard to actually believe that that's how we, for all intents and purposes, met, you know, and because we're such firm friends. Her daughter is my daughter's best friend and they're on FaceTime all the time. And it's just, you know, to say something's truly beautiful, I look at that, I value that relationship. And it is truly one of the most beautiful parts of my life to have that with her, and the continuation of it, if you like, with our children is just, it is absolutely beautiful.
Mm, yeah, that sounds very special.
Yeah.
We were having a conversation before we started the interview around how we could take some of the learnings you've kind of taken for yourself out of this whole life-changing experience, and what that might mean to, let's say, business owners who, you know, a lot of business owners, they kind of live and exist for their business rather than their business is there to give them a life that they love. So what kind of lessons have you taken out based on where you were at before that bombing and where you are now?
Yeah, look, it's sort of bittersweet for me because I you know, arrived in London a very young person. I'd lost both my parents, and in a way that was a sort of catalyst, if you like, for me to just take a big leap of faith and to really look at, you know, if I put myself into a major world city where I don't know anyone, I don't know anything, I'll either sink or swim. Mm. And so I love that sort of naivety around what I didn't know, I didn't know. And in a way, I kind of miss that. I miss the naivety of youth. I wish I could keep that because I think it keeps us taking risks where we are quite bold in our abilities to say whatever comes at me, I can do because we are invincible. And I think that's the gift of youth in a way, that there's this sense of I'm completely invincible and indestructible. I then sort of fell into that trap though of being a foreigner in a very tough city, working in a predominantly male dominated field. Being rather short, I was only just 5 foot, and being, you know, a young Australian female. And so I self-imposed, if you like, an idea that I had to work, you know, not just twice as hard as everyone else, but, you know, 10 times as hard as everyone else. And look, it did pay off. I ended up climbing some very impressive ranks. I was very much contributing to the cultural landscape, if you like, of London. And that's extraordinary to be able to do that. I was there for a total of 26 years of my life. It's a place that I still call home, if you like, an extraordinary city. But I now look back on all of those moments where, particularly living in London, where people go to Italy and go skiing and go off on fantastic holidays because it's so available to do. Mm. And one moment stands out very clearly for me, and that is when friends said they're all going skiing for me to come, and I said, absolutely not. I've got reports to write and you know, things to do. I'm not going. And that was the last opportunity I would have had to know what it would have felt like to have skied with having been full bodied, you know, and it's all of those things that I didn't, you know, I'd come back to Australia for, you know, little holidays and if you like, but I'm always working, looking at, you know, what I could be doing. I didn't take time out to just walk and paddle at the ocean's edge. You know, it's just like, what was I thinking? I was in Australia, but I was still working. So for me, it's, I think perhaps I would have been a better boss. I had two companies while I was in London. I was in charge of a team at the Design Council. I think I would have been a better boss had I had a sort of a more expansive life and I did more outside of work, because I think I would have appreciated life in a very different way. I lived to work, and for me now, wonderfully, I still have the same habits that I had then. I've sort of said, oh, well, what the hell, I can't go skiing, so it doesn't matter. But I think for me what's different now is that purpose sits at the core. So rather than even having to think, oh, gosh, am I waking up to work, to live, to work, what am I doing?
Hmm.
Having a not-for-profit, you know, there's a hint there in even its title. There is no profit. You know, there's a whole different financial life that I now have and have to manage compared to where I was in life number one. And so that in itself is a whole different appreciation. But for me, because purpose sits at the core, then, you know, everything is about what I'm doing with my life rather than how much money I'm making to fund the not-for-profit. So it's very interesting, very complete flip on where I was at before. But I would absolutely say it's important to take that time to realise, you know, why you're doing what you do, and, you know, that there has to be the enjoyment, the fruits of your labour, so to speak, from all the hard work and effort that you're putting in.
Hmm. That's great advice. And it, in some ways, taking time away from the work and the, you know, the office or whatever it may be, actually gives you the freedom to think about purpose some more and to formulate that. And I was listening to something this morning that was a presentation around a very successful business that's grown quite rapidly over the last 5 years. And the key that this person pointed out was the moment they didn't focus on making money but started to really, well, what's their purpose, and live to deliver that purpose. And it's a business to deliver, to make profit. But, you know, once they focused on this is our purpose, this is our audience, we have to deliver this for this audience, that the success started happening. So really focusing on the purpose.
I totally agree with that. And look, it's been very interesting being back in South Australia, because you know, one of the things I'm drawn to now is just to sit and look at the ocean. And we have a wonderful coastline here. And you know, because we're a quieter place, perhaps, than the larger cities of Melbourne, Sydney, but I almost see that as an advantage, because I'm just able to think. And just looking at the ocean, there's this wonderful sort of, if you like, leveller of the ocean, just saying, oh, you're so insignificant. Whatever you're worried about, so insignificant, because I've been here and I'm going to go out with my tide, I'm going to come back. And it's this wonderful sort of recalibration, if you like, where I then sort of smile at myself and think, yes, I'm completely insignificant, and I'll go back now and do some more insignificant stuff behind my computer. But it's a wonderful, nature's a great thing, and I never felt that before. You know, I was really absolutely, totally engaged with, and particularly with architecture, with a very built, heavily built up urban environment and stimulation that gave me. Now I'm starting to really appreciate the majesty and the wisdom around things that have been here far longer than I have.
Yeah, and the little things as well. I noticed before there was a bird chirping away very animatedly outside your window or wherever there in the background, and I thought, oh, okay, there's something else going on that, you know, he or she doesn't care what we're doing. And
that is beautiful. Yeah, yeah. And exactly that. And that's a moment of being completely present, really in tune with where you are and just saying, wow, what a great day this is. You know, how lovely that I get to appreciate this wonderful bird that's just popped in. You know, it's fantastic.
Hmm. Well, this is really fascinating, Jill. I could go on and talk for ages, but I do respect your time. We do have an innovation round that we ask people, and since you've kind of had quite a lot of business experience in the past, so I'll go through that now, but feel free to take this wherever you feel is appropriate, whether it's in relation to what you're doing now with Make a Difference for Peace, whether it's around, you know, the lessons that a horrendous event like this gave you or whatever. So so essentially the idea is that it's a series of questions that will help our audience learn from tips from your experience and hopefully inspire them, which I'm sure you're quite capable of doing. So the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Absolutely have an open mind. So not to go into anything with already the conclusion to what you're looking for, but to have an open mind of what things may come from a session of thinking.
Great advice. I think you talk about not making assumptions about people in some of your presentations as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just to sort of add to that, that for me, even looking at the learning of what did that bomber teach me, and the bomber taught me something vital that I've absolutely brought into my whole working and life philosophy now, and that is to, you know, never ever presume anything about anyone you don't know. And equally, you know, we can do that with anything. We're trying to find a solution to something. We can't go in presuming that we've got the answer. You know, having an open mind is, I think, the foremost crucial tool to coming up with a conclusion for anything, because we don't know. The answer could be buried in in a sense somewhere that we would never even imagine looking, but when we're still and we have an open mind, it presents itself.
That's right, yeah. And it's a little bit around that youthful naivety that you mentioned earlier, to have the curiosity to set aside judgment.
Yeah.
All right, so what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Well, rather practically, so I have the whole length of my office as a blackboard. So everything I do is visual, and and every word, everything goes on a blackboard, and that's the way that I tease out, if you like, of a direction of where to go to somewhere. So it's perhaps design thinking, but I just like to see it. So for me, the best way of developing new ideas or products is to write down your beginning and your pathway, and you start to see where you're going. But for me, it's visual, absolutely visual. And I hate to presume. I'll generalize. Most innovators, I would generalize to say that they're visual thinkers.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually quite challenged to go into visual thinking mode, but then again, I do like to get up and draw on my whiteboard. So, and I do like to map out piles. So I do love that. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what's do you have a favorite tool or system for improving your productivity?
I use a lot of design methodologies. So that's where the driver for me is always the need. So I start with what's the need. And again, you know, having a very open mind, what are all the things that could float from the need so that we could create the right solution to fulfill that need? So in essence, that's just pure, you know, I even like to call it common sense. You know, it's far to say that. But for the sake of making sure that we, you know, have the proper rigor to this, I would say it's using design methodologies.
Yeah, yeah, that's great advice. But you know what they say about common sense, it's not so common.
Yeah. True, yeah.
Yeah. All right, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
To always remind yourself and your team of the why.
Mm.
Why are we doing this project? Why does it matter? Why are we all sitting here, you know, trying to make it happen? So always have that reminder of the why, the purpose.
Yeah, it's great. Great advice. I'm a huge fan of Simon Sinek's Start With Why.
Yes,
absolutely. And, yeah, having that in mind always, I mean, yeah. It makes decisions so easy, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hmm. All right. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Look, I think it's actually quite hard. And I'll to follow on from what we've just said, I think it's important to believe in your purpose. So to stay true to the why are you here? Why are you doing this? And, you know, I think it's easier said than done. I think this is where a lot of people lose their way because they get caught in answering to their accountants, to making sure that have we got more profit and what's my editor doing, and I need to make sure I've got something that's going to outsell his or her line of whatever. And it's so easy to forget, why am I here? What's brilliant about my product? And if I can't answer that, then find the brilliance to your product. Focus on what you are doing. Forget about, you know, the accountant. Forget about everyone else. Even if it's just momentarily, put them on hold and say, I'm focusing on the brilliance of what I do. Mm. And that will be my differentiator. That will be the thing. But it's so important to stay true and to really believe in the purpose of what you're doing, because that's infectious in itself. And then if you're the leader, you're the boss that's your attitude, it almost is a beautiful ripple effect that gets reflected back in your teams, in your staff, of everyone understands why they're there, what we're doing, and how brilliant this thing is, whatever that is.
Hmm, that's great advice, yeah. And believe in that, and don't and stay true to it. So it's really good.
And it is hard. And I would say that's they're the skills that we've almost got to keep reminding ourselves to hone and to be working at. To say, wake up every morning and say, why am I going into work? What is it? And what am I going to achieve today for myself as well? What do I want to feel? And they're important things, I think, to just anchor yourself in your purpose and why you're here contributing to whatever you're contributing.
Mm. Yeah, I think you started off saying believe in your purpose and believe in yourself, and I think that's probably one of the key parts of that. I think a lot of small business owners have a couple of things that I was on the discussion this morning about as well. The FOMO, or fear of missing out, and the imposter syndrome. So they're not sure if they're good enough or if their product or services is good enough. Yes. So then they listen to the accountant or they listen to somebody else and say, oh, okay, maybe I'll change direction or maybe I'll make a tweak here and modify things. So, so that's the danger.
And I think that's really interesting, because if you don't think your product is good enough, then that's your reason to wake up every day to say, I'm going to make this product brilliant.
Mm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Focus on that. And that in itself, what a great driver to say, I've got a good product, but I don't think it's the best. Let's make it the best. Mm. That's, changes everything.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked earlier about, I think this was pre-interview as well, the power of words. So, that's magic. I like that. So, change the purpose a little bit.
Mm. Absolutely. And if you feel that you're an imposter, then I don't think it cuts it when the general response to that is, look, everybody feels like that, because it's you can't really relate to that. No, I'm surrounded by experts, so then it's okay, what do I need to do to skill up to make me feel less of an imposter? Is that, do I need to read? Do I need to do courses? Is this the right field for me to be in? Because if I feel so insecure, then am I doing the right thing? That's my purpose, where I think, great, I'm contributing. And if you still answer yes to that, then skill up. You know, it's all there. Everything's there. I've got another little thing that I'm really working on at the moment that I love to ponder. I think that's a fabulous thing to do. and my thing is that everything we need, we already have.
Yeah.
And that's also in that wrapped up is the internal confidence to be able to put your hand up to say, I don't know what I'm doing. So everything we need, we already have. And when you feel that, it changes everything again, because that allows a confidence to say, I've got a whole heap of great stuff. I could probably use some more. How do I get that? And who do I reach out to? And where do I put my hand up? And that is about just being confidently yourself. So everything we need, we have, is something I'm going with that at the moment.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. I've done a lot of NLP training, and that is one of the core tenets of NLP, that everything we need, we have inside of us. Right. Now, it might not be the expertise relative to some other expert or specialist in their field, but you've got the know-how to get to that level if you want to, if you have the drive and the purpose.
And I bring this back to personal experience as well, Jürgen, that, you know, if I was told on July the 6th, the day before the bombings, you know, you will go on in life as a double amputee, you'll learn to walk again on prosthetic legs, I would have said, absolutely no way. There is no way I could do that. And, you know, here I am. I've walked the length from Leeds down to London. Yeah. I've spent a month on the road, you know, on prosthetic legs, done things that have stretched my understanding of myself, you know, over and over and over again. And so therefore I'm absolutely convinced that everything I did need was already there. And it's just a matter of listening to myself and saying, absolutely, you can do that. And if you don't know how to do it, go and ask.
All right. Well, as I say, this is really fascinating and I could talk for longer, but maybe we'll have a second episode at some stage.
Part two.
Yeah. We'll check up on you again in a little while. So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give then to any business owner who wants to be a leader in their field and wants to kind of be successful?
I would say it's so important to get the investment, both emotionally, professionally, purposely, from everyone that works in your teams, so that everyone shares in the reason why we're here, and to not exclude in that way, so that everyone's contribution is acknowledged, that they all know that they're the essential cog in that wheel. To make the outcome happen. And that to me is then creating very positive, purpose-driven working environments where people are, you know, understand what they're doing actually contributes to the bigger picture. And therefore it's not just a job, if you like, but they're coming to share some of their life every day to contribute to the purpose, and that's their purpose. So I think it's important to make sure that everyone's invested in the outcome.
That's really great advice. And it kind of maybe. Sorry?
And gets to share in the outcome of how, you know, what did happen, what was that product doing? And, oh, wow, you know, that's amazing. I got to play a small role in that, but without me, it wouldn't have happened. And I think it's really important for people to feel that they're valued in that way.
It's good you said that last bit, because when you were saying the whole thing, I was thinking back to that you actually lived that in relation to the people that were involved in your rescue and your rehabilitation and recovery. Yeah,
absolutely. So, and beautifully or frustratingly, actually, when I sort of approached every single person that was involved in my life being saved, and I said, yeah, just wow, how do I thank you? And, you know, one after one after one, they were each saying, I was just doing my job.
Mm.
And it really got to me because I just thought, wow, you know, how is that a job? you've shown me what we're capable of as human beings. So if that's what you want to call a job, then, you know, where do I get recruitment to do that, or where do I sign up? You know, it was just extraordinary. So they've really shown me, indeed, how to not only live my second life, but how to be the messenger and the communicator of all that their actions did.
Mm. All right. Well, where can people reach out and thank you for sharing your story with us today and sharing your insights?
Very, very welcoming of email, which is Jill with a G at madminds, madminds.org.
Okay, and we'll post a link to that along with the website, your website, Mad for Peace website, the Mad Minds website, and a bunch of YouTube videos that I think are well worth people going to have a look at, because I've got so much more about your story, which is very moving indeed and very inspirational, what you've achieved so far. So before we finish up, Jill, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
Well, I would love you to speak to a very interesting man called Steve Killerly. And Steve is the founder of the Global Peace Index. And just brilliantly, actually, he's a businessman. He's an Australian businessman in the IT field. And brilliantly, Steve came up with the whole idea that we value and we know the economics of war, but do we appreciate the economics of peace? And if peace could be provided as an economic platform for the, you know, the urgency of keeping peace and ensuring that peace is the absolute top of the agenda over the very widely understood, economics of war, then would countries and leadership be more prone to making sure that they adopted a peaceful model? So that's the work he does. It's absolutely fascinating. And coming from a business perspective, he's really put a business slant on the value of peace.
Yeah, that does sound really fascinating, because I often wonder about the whole economics of war and the drivers that you know, and how much do we contribute to that indirectly, because we're all looking to have a certain level of affluence, and some of that indirectly comes back to, you know, the economy, which somewhere is driven by some war stuff. So, yeah, that'd be fascinating. So, Steve, keep an eye. Steve Killen. Okay, so yeah, keep an eye on your inbox. We're coming to get you, courtesy of Jill Hicks.
Whoa, brilliant.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us today, Jill. I've really enjoyed this. As I say, I do strongly encourage people to buy Jill's book and read it. I read it and I was in tears a lot of the time. It's very moving. But also very inspirational, and also have a look at the links to the videos that I post on the podcast. So thanks, Jill.
Thank you so much.
And all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Lovely. Thanks, Jürgen.
Wow, what an amazing lady. I'm sure you'll agree that Jill is an inspirational person and that her work is so important. On a personal level, I encourage everyone to take some of the lessons of this episode on board. Now, all the ideas and tips that Jill shared with us can be found at novabiz.co/Jill Hicks, that is .co/GILLHICKS, all lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/JillHicks. Now, you'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Jill there, as well as the links to her website and a range of talks she has given, and also her book. A note for our regular listeners, we have changed the short link for our episodes. So from today, we'll be using innovabiz.co, that's C-O, followed by the episode keyword. Jill suggested I interview Steve Killerly of the Global Peace Index on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So Steve, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Jill Hicks. Now, you might get sick of hearing me say this next bit, but someone reminded me this week that it's vitally important to keep reminding people, and that repetition is, in fact, a good thing. So if you haven't already done so, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Cast, your favourite place to listen to podcasts, and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you'll never miss a future episode. We'd love you to leave us a review, because we always welcome feedback, and of course reviews help us get found, help us spread the message to a bigger audience, and also let us know how we are doing. If there's anything you'd like us to cover, things you want us to improve or change, questions you want answered on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, or indeed guests you'd like us to interview, please send those ideas to us as well. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.